Welcome to Holden Village in the Fireside Room. Today's speaker is Paul Olson, and he will be doing a session entitled No One is an Island, Literature and Community. So let's listen in on Paul.
Literature and community is kind of a new thing for me and a new exploration into a step back from lots of literature and say, what are the big generalizations that it speaks to me? It, meaning this whole body of literature. And one of the things that it spoke to me was literature is about community. That exercise has been really worthwhile for me as a teacher and as a student of literature. And I think it's the experience can be analogous to how most of us read the Bible. If we read it at all, we read a little bit here, and then we don't read it for a few days, then we read a little bit more. Or we just listen to the lessons of the day on Sunday, and we never really step back and get the whole big picture and those grand themes that run from the Old to the New Testament. Themes of freedom, themes of, to sound like an English teacher, existential stripping, themes of coming to self-realization, themes of community. And anyway, in doing that with literature, I really kind of had a fun awakening and exercise, and I hadn't ever done that in this way until I got to Holden this time. So this really is fresh stuff for you guys who have been hanging out with me for years. I borrowed the title of this from the 16th century language of John Donne, who didn't say no one is an island, he said no man is an island. But if he were hip today at Holden, he'd use inclusive language. And I want to read the whole thing. It's very short. That he has on, it's the 17th meditation, and they numbered them in those days, and that makes it easier to look them up, I guess. But there seemed to be a tradition of when someone died, you'd ring the bell. And then someone says, well, who died? Or for whom? Get the old phrase, you know, for whom does the bell toll? And on the basis of that, he titled this, Now This Bell Tolling Softly for Another Says to Me, Thou Must Die. Now, in the midst of that depressing note, I'm going to change the tone a little bit. The whole piece, the whole meditation goes like this. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the lesser, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of the friends or thine own were, because any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. There's a couple ideas going on in there, but the highlight one that I'm going to use to focus on today is any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and no man is an island. No woman either. One of the things that where that's brought it home to me in my childhood is growing up in this community of lots of Norwegians and this family that was broad. My mother had seven siblings, my dad had seven siblings, and when we got together there were just thousands of little Norwegians running around. It was absolutely awful. So we grew up all the Norwegian stories, and if you haven't read on Wes's wall down near the bulletin board, a Norwegian mother writing to her son. I think it's a pink, or I don't remember the color, but it's a colored little sheet. You have to read that, and parts of it are, it starts out, Dear son, I'm writing this slowly because I know you can't read fast. And already she's into this idea of the Norwegian community, understanding her Norwegian son and anybody else Norwegian. And later on, my favorite one in that letter, is that, son, I went to the doctor today, and this man, the doctor put a glass tube in my mouth and told me to keep quiet for 2 minutes. After we left, your pa offered to buy it from him. And it's full of those, and you'll enjoy that. It's on Wes's wall. And I think of our dean at Augustana College is from Norway, and he is Norwegian. And I joked with him the other day that he got a service award, a gold medal for service to the community, and went right out and had it bronzed. We just don't think. And then I reminded the little community in Minnesota near where I grew up the day that the library burned, and everybody was just distraught because both books went up with it. And as the newspaper said, and one of them hadn't even been colored in yet. And my wife has the same kind of, this is really kind of unbelievable, but true, the same kind of Norwegian background. All of her grandparents were born in Norway. All of my grandparents, or great-grandparents, were born in Norway. And, we're 3 or 4 generations from the boat, and to happen to meet and get married, so our poor kids are full-blooded Norwegian, too. And the Norwegianness, Norwegians really are stupid. And my wife is a hospital chaplain, and because of that job, she's on call every other weekend or so. And if there's a reason for a chaplain to get to the hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning, she's got to go. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, a couple of weeks ago, just before we came to Holden, we get the phone rings, and she says, "Hello, this is Chaplain Olson." And the guy immediately just goes into this long apology. "Oh, I got the wrong number. I'm sorry. I woke you up at 2 o'clock in the morning." And my wife's comment was, "That's okay. I had to get up to answer the phone anyway." So she's Norwegian and full-blooded, I can tell you. And then she walks there. That's okay.
Can I miss something? Yeah. That was a nice start.
Just answering the phone.
Just answering the phone. Well, my contention as I look at literature is that this community sense is a process. And I did that last night. How do we achieve community, and how do we perceive what a community is? That's all part of this look at how literature suggests that humankind needs community and requires community. I'm going to argue from the literature that I show you that this is a process, and that it's not necessarily, or it's not just a goal, an end, that, okay, well, now we've achieved a community. That is true. And that is one of the things that I think that great writers try to achieve, is that to lead us towards a sense of other, and the sense of community, and the sense of sisterhood, brotherhood, and so on. The words, all different kinds of words we can use to recognize or to be synonyms of community. But this process of community, I think, as I look at literature, is kind of cyclical. And it involves, strangely enough, this sense of losing one's sense of self. And so to lose one's sense of self, you have to first be self-aware. And as I reflected on this morning in preparation too, I thought of a lot of the stuff that, if you were here for any of George Tinker's, the Indian theologian sessions about community, and how, as he talked about Indian community, his audiences often resisted it. Because it suggested, ooh, I didn't know that about myself, I didn't know that about our culture, and so on. Okay, and so the self-awareness process is part of coming to community. I'll be specific in a second to illustrate what I mean. But I want to set up this kind of umbrella to give a context to the literature that we're going to look at. So this process of self-awareness then eventually leads to a kind of self-negation, and that's too strong a word, and I don't know of another one. If I would never let a freshman in English write the word existential on a paper. I wouldn't let a senior write it on the paper because I don't understand it. And don't give me that stuff I don't understand. But there's a kind of self-stripping, a kind of existential stripping of all that we are, so we can finally come to an awareness of how we connect with others. And until that process goes on, we don't really grasp the power of community. Okay, let me give some illustrations. The first thing I did is just kind of sat back and did this thing with the Bible and reflected, how does the Bible bring us to the sense of community? And there's a zillion ways, and I'm not a theologian, and I'm not a Bible scholar, but I do pay attention to the literary qualities of the stuff I read. And it's clear, I think, that from the beginning of this whole stuff in the Bible, that when Abraham is told, I'm going to give you a new land, what does he have to do? He has to leave his old one. And not only does he have to leave his old one, and I'm borrowing a lot of ideas here from Eric Fromm, who wrote a book called Ye Shall Be as Gods. And Eric Fromm is a Jewish philosopher. And in that book, he suggests that the whole process of the Old Testament is this leaving behind what he calls incestuous ties before we can become, we can have any kind of sense about who we are individually in connection with other people. Well, and one of his illustrations is, and that's where I'm crediting him for this idea, is that Abraham had to do that. Abraham, well, let me bring my family. No, you can't bring your family. You can't bring those incestuous ties. Well, let me bring my, Abraham's got his gods. No, you can't bring those either. And we're going to leave all that, and in the process, and you know the whole story as it moves on through Genesis and Exodus, that we've got to have this kind of wilderness experience, don't we? I mean, the Jews are then in captivity, and before they, and we're stepping back, looking at the big story now, they have to be in captivity, and then Moses comes along and says, okay, we're going to go out here in freedom, and we're out here in freedom, and where are we wandering? In the wilderness, trying to come to terms with who we are, and who our God is, and how this God will lead us. And interestingly enough, and I alluded to this just a little bit the other night in a different context in a different session, of course. The Hebrews tell Moses three different times. And again, English teacher in me tells me, oops, that means something if it's said three times. That, hey, Moses, we'd rather be back there in Egypt. This is too hard. I don't want to. And as I listen to people resist what Tink talked about with the Kairos moment, if that's another thing we can talk about it after the session, I guess. And talked about the whole Indian culture and a different set of values and the power of capitalism. You know, he brings up that awful word. I mean, that we should even think, is he a communist or what? To reassess all these things that this whole system has done to our values, he asks us to reassess that. We resist. Not unlike the Hebrews resisted Moses. Let's go back. It's better to die in the flesh pots of Egypt than to wander in the wilderness, they tell him, three times. I mean, I think the writer had something in mind about our human resistance to wilderness experiences and to come into finally, well, in this case, for them, the promised land. Well, a couple other places too, and I'm not going to read, it's full, in the Bible, it's full of illustrations of this kind of idea, but another one that I just found this morning in Zechariah 3:10. The prophet there, Zechariah, is envisioning a better day. And in that assessment of this, what this better day will be, he says, in that day, says the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor under his vine and under his fig tree. Oh. You mean I have to invite my neighbor? It's not just me. And I think as an American literature student, one of the things that's been passed on to us is that the rugged individualism of American literature and of American experience, the white Anglo-male American experience, of rugged individualism really isn't the whole truth about the American experience and the American experience as it interacted with the culture that was already here and as also as they interacted with each other. So, again, in that day, in this day of community, in this day that's going to be a better day, it's going to be community, says the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor under his vine and under his fig tree. And later in Zechariah, these are things that you shall do. Speak the truth to one another. Render in your gates judgments that are true and make for peace. Now, that doesn't say much about community necessarily, except that it is speak the truth to one another. And that's part of this process that says, you know, and I'm going to borrow from Tink's illustration yesterday. We want this McDonald's hamburger, and the fact that we do and that we have to supply that want relates to the burning of the forests in Brazil. And because they got to produce more corn to feed more cattle and to get us more beef. And we, and here, I live in Iowa and work in Illinois, great beef places. We got to have even more than what we produce. Well, says Zechariah, speak the truth to one another. Render in your gates judgments that are true and make for peace. More. The books, the prophet, it's really one, and I think, and I'm not a Bible scholar, but I just dabbled in this a little bit. Ezra and Nehemiah, the two prophets, are really, they think, one prophet, and they get split and somehow because I guess it's, you know, you don't want to read one long book, so you get to read one short one today and one short one tomorrow, I guess.
same reason they put verses and stuff like that in the Bible. But Ezra and Nehemiah were clearly prophets that practiced and wrote about ethnocentrism. You better not marry anybody but a Jew, a Hebrew. And you better not live, and you better not worship. And it's all kind of with a kind of ethnocentrism. And historically, I mean, again, I'm not a Bible scholar, but I've read this stuff, that the scholars tell us that Ruth and Jonah, those two books, are responses by those writers to the ethnocentrism of the prophets Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ruth, as you know, I mean, that's a famous story, who does she marry? A Moabite. I mean, that's a pretty much, those guys are enemies. They are cursed. We go back to Lot and Moab, and Moabite, you know, Moab's one of the sons of Lot, and that incestuous relationship, and that they're not cool people. And she violates that, and the writer suggests maybe there's more to this idea about community. And Jonah, who's he instructed to go save? Yeah, Assyrians. They've been beating on the Israelis for centuries. And wait a minute, God, I'm not going to do it. And you know the whole story. And God doesn't let them off the hook because there's some kind, and I think these writers are after this insistence about, we've got to understand that our community is broader than it is. Well, I'm going to just rip through quickly some things out of Matthew before I get to the stuff that where I'm more at home. But this matters, I think, to give it a context that goes on and that touches our Christian faith, I think, as well. Not that only the Bible can touch our Christian faith. I'm just going to read these and let you think about them in a sense of community rather than maybe the context we've given them before. Not that another context is wrong. You have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council, and whoever says, you fool, shall be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar and there, remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. And I just encourage you to think about that in the context of community. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? I had a teacher in history once say, well, Hitler loved his kids. I mean, he didn't have any kids. But that his metaphor was big deal. You know, that loving people, you know, that good people can't commit racist acts. That reminds me of that anyway. So there it is. If you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same. And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. This is a different context now than we often get this, but I'm suggesting that this is a statement about community. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Just two more. And I have a list of more than two, but I want you to have a chance to respond, and I want to look at some literature too. Then Peter came up and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me, and I forgive him? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, I do not say to you seven times, but 70 times seven. Think about that in the sense of community. Do you remember doing this as a little kid? I did this. I read that passage and I wrote, 7 times 70, 490. Okay, I got a few to go and then I'm done. I have to forgive those guys. Well, great literary artists, great writers, I think speak to this idea of community too, and I'm going to start out with something very familiar to all of you, I would think,
just from your high school days or your college days, a poem by Robert Frost. It's called Mending Wall. It's the poem that that he read when they erected the wall, you know, in Berlin after World War II. And there's some images I want to set up for you to pay attention to. And the first one is that this guy comes upon this wall, I mean, and they're going to go repair it, as you might remember, or might not. They're going to repair this stone wall that runs between the two properties, his property and his neighbor's. And he starts out with the line, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall." And he doesn't know quite what it is, because it's always down. And something's always knocking this thing down. And so something must not love the wall. And then he speculates on things that could knock it down, and he knows about those, and he mentions them. For instance, the frost heaves the stones off the wall, and that's one reason. He said, but that's not it. And then hunters come along, and they're after a rabbit, and the dog is barking like crazy, roof, 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 and he reaches in, and he pulls out these rocks, and they take out these rocks wide enough that two guys could walk abreast through them to please the yelping dog, he says. Well, that's not what I mean either. The gaps I'm talking about, the poet says, they just happen because there's something there is that doesn't love a wall. Later in the poem, and it's not a long poem at all, he says, maybe it's elves. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly. And there's something about Frost, the rugged individualist poet who suggests the power of community and what it means to us and to develop those kind of relationships. Well, this is about what I'm trying to suggest now, this process of community. First, the self-awareness, and then the stripping away of what's good for me and what's best for me, to begin to ask questions of what's better for the community. And in the poem, it's just what's better for my neighbor and for us. And here's this real familiar poem. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have not left one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen to each. Some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. That's an interesting line, isn't it? I'm going to put this wall up, and then if it doesn't stay, I don't care. But stay where you are till our backs are turned, and then we'll move on. But gotta get it up. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines. I tell him that, and he only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built the wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees, because he will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. What's your sense about that? I had a teacher in college who was so shy, he couldn't look at the class.
And when if he was confronted with a moment of silence like that, he would absolutely, I think he wet his pants. But he just couldn't confront that silence, and so he'd be there with his papers or book or whatever up like this, and just kind of peer over every now and then. There's more to the story, but I don't have time. Okay, so I'm not afraid of your silence. But I want you to kind of just think about that a little bit. What's the impact of that poem? What does it make you feel?
What?
Yeah, felt one, two, and then here.
I just read in the Sunday magazine section of the newspaper about a couple, two women who lived next to each other somewhere around Seattle. They decided to take down the fence between them. They share all their gardening tools, and they share flowers and plants and starts and things. And I thought, now that's really unusual to have a neighbor that would be so homogenous to your own taste or to your own. Yeah, so maybe community is easy if you pick people that like the same thing, the same attitude and the same feeling around.
Yeah. Great illustration. Or maybe community is easier if you just take down the fence and find out. Yeah, that's a great story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Karen. I just met Karen this morning in the jacuzzi after our respective runs.
We just moved to a community, 7 years ago, after not living in any community that ever had walls. And Phoenix is full of walls. And it is the hardest city I've ever had to live in because it's so difficult to know our neighbors. You have to walk out the front door and around. I mean, it's just a very different concept from walking out the back door, mowing the lawn, seeing your neighbor, saying hi on a spring day when everybody's out there, or even washing the car in the front yard where everybody does that. And so where we see our neighbors now is out running on the street. Maybe that's one reason I run so diligently. At least I see somebody else in the neighborhood. But that whole sense of community then has been very difficult for me to develop for myself in the context of a larger community that's walled.
I can't help but think just what even this particular poem about the extra maintenance that's needed, that you're building something that, now you mentioned mowing the lawn, going around the fence is so difficult and having to trim it and everything else. It's like we have a fence because of dogs, but if we didn't, it wouldn't make much sense because you just start adding additional work for yourself, having to continually maintain it, and it doesn't do you any good with your neighbors.
Yeah, but it's my property and I'm gonna fence it in. And I mean, that's a good illustration too.
It triggered a story. We visited some friends in Germany years ago, and they had been in the United States for about 6 months previous to our visit, and we were walking through a little country village and surrounding farms, and he said, "Do you see something's missing?" And of course, being pretty dense, we didn't try to tell us that the people don't fence their farms unless they have animals. There's no fences unless they have animals. He said, but you Americans, you have fences around everything, and even if it's just a plot of corn, the corn's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Especially if animals to keep out.
How does this idea that we just encountered in this poem, or this experience in this poem, fit the process of self-awareness? What about the speaker in the poem? Who initiates this?
He does.
I do. I tell him on a day, on a spring day, let's go. And yet he calls this guy, he moves in darkness, and he won't go behind his father's saying, but hey, buddy, it's time to fix our fence. It's just so automatic. And this value has been there, and they don't question. He questions it, but still does it. I think that's an incredible statement about self-awareness and how hooked he is by this, in this case, his traditions. Or in a political sense, the system that's there, we just respond within that, even when we know better. And so his actions and his words are really quite different, aren't they? Even to the point, I highlighted that, is stay there when your backs are turned. I'm going to put that thing up. I don't care what it means. It'll fall down afterwards. I don't care. I did it. I put it up. And I got it done. Well, it gets better, I think, or more complicated and more profound, just because he's got more time to do it. In a wonderful book about South Africa by Andre Brink, and Gordon Jackson recommended this as one of the readings for someone interested in the South African experience under apartheid. This book is about a white teacher. I was going to say liberal, but that's not even true. He's a good guy, and he really doesn't have any political kind of leanings. He'd rather not be political. And he's white. He's a teacher at a private school of all white students. And the janitor, of course, is black. And the janitor's son is arrested at one of the Soweto marches. And this maybe will help too. Johannesburg might sit like this, and Soweto, I mean, and then Johannesburg is going to be all white, and Soweto is all black. Johannesburg is surrounded by black townships. Or one of them, if you know about this, one of them might be colored, one of them might be Indian, colored meaning a mixture of black and white. But the white community is surrounded by that. And there aren't, though there are fences around lots of houses, in fact, I guess now I back up and say there are fences around most houses and gates and locks and push the button and it opens and you drive in, you don't have to get out to unlock it. There's a lot of that stuff there. But if where the white man, Ben, teaches and the black man comes in to do his janitor work and goes back home to Soweto, the black man's younger son marches in a protest march against the Afrikaners. It doesn't matter the Afrikaners' statements about apartheid. And he's arrested. And then he disappears and they find out he's been killed. Well, this janitor named Gordon begins to investigate the murder of what he thinks is the murder of his son. And as we, I think if we've read any newspapers at all, we know that hundreds, literally hundreds of black, especially men and boys, were beaten to death in the jail cells and then just thrown out and said that died of natural causes. Well, Gordon, the black janitor, begins to investigate this. And in the process, he sort of pulls in, really quite inadvertently, just because he tells him about it, he pulls in this white school teacher who really doesn't want anything to do with the politics of this, and who, in fact, has never in his life been outside of Johannesburg, the white community. He gets on the superhighway and goes past it, and you can see down there if he looked, but he's never really ever been in the community. And you get the sense of this process in a minute. Well, he gets more and more involved, and then the janitor gets arrested for pushing his voice too much against the establishment, and then they find him 10 days later hanged in his cell, and they say he hung himself, and Ben just doesn't believe it. Now, Ben doesn't have any idea of that the system could be wrong. He said, I'm going to go into the system and say, they wouldn't do this. It can't. Why did Gordon kill himself? I want to find out. Never imagining that the system was brutal and evil and would just kill black people at a will, at a whim. Well, we have the language of the author that speaks far better than I do. In the process of this investigation, Ben, the white teacher, who is non-political, meets a guy who was willing to, a black guy, who's willing to drive him around to these places, and the black guy comes to his house. This is not a dynamic, intense scene, or it's intense, but it's not a dynamic a scene. But listen and just see what you feel. The black man is in his house. There has never been a black, well, here it is. When the kettle started boiling, he had a moment of uncertainty. Should he offer Stanley one of the new cups Susan used for guests, or an old one? It was the first time in his life he had to entertain a black visitor. Annoyed by his own indecision, he opened and shut the cupboard doors aimlessly. In the end, picking two old, unmatched cups and saucers no longer in use, he measured out the teaspoons of instant coffee and poured boiling water into the cups. He put milk and sugar on the tray and, almost guiltily, hurried out of the kitchen. Now he goes out and serves them. But do you get with me? With the consciousness that he has suddenly of, I'm going to use the word, that there's a broader community in my life here, and I don't even know how to respond to it. And even something so trivial as serving coffee, he doesn't know what to do. Stanley was standing in front of a bookshelf, his back turned to the door. So you're a history man, boss? Oh, in a way, yes. He put the tray in a corner of the desk. Help yourself. Yeah, thank you. Then, laughing with what seemed to be deliberate provocation, and what has all your history taught you, boss? Ben shrugged. Stanley replied on his behalf, to hell with it all, returning to his chair. You want to know why? Because you ladies, you in America, it'd be honkies, I think. Because you ladies keep thinking history is made right here where you are and no place else. Why don't you come with me one day? I'll show you what history really looks like. Bare-assed history, stinking with life, over at my place in Soweto. One of the things that we heard from Zechariah, listen to it, render in your gates judgments that are true and make for peace. You shall do this, speak the truth to one another. So part of this sense of community is an awareness of truthful history as well. And Stanley says, come on, I'm going to take you. And this process of self-awareness, and the next one we haven't come to yet, is going to be right here as he moves from Johannesburg to the black township Soweto. 4 years ago, I was in South Africa. I got off the plane and was met by a white woman, 62 years old. It was the only time I was with white people the whole time I was there. And she said, you know, thinking that I'm an American and therefore a liberal and suspect of every white South African there is, which I probably was, and which isn't fair. But she said, you know, I just saw the movie Cry Freedom. And the Cry Freedom is a wonderful movie. You can get it at Blockbuster or any place. True story about Stephen Biko, the martyred medical student who was beaten to death in his jail cell and because he was protesting apartheid. This woman said to me, I just saw Cry Freedom last week, and I had no idea it was like that. She had been living in South Africa for 62 years, in Johannesburg for 62 years, and she had no idea it was going on like that. That's absolutely impossible unless one is so focused on your own experience, right? And you have not stripped away anything of your own self-awareness. You're aware only of yourself. That's an irony now that I'm going to use in a minute. First, you know, she is so self-aware that she's not aware of anything else, and I'm suggesting one of the first steps toward community is to become self-aware, and that is to be self-aware about your own self-awareness. Okay? Everybody follow that? I don't think I did. Well, Ben gets to ride with Stanley in his taxi, and they go to... they go into Soweto. A sense of total strangeness as they reach the first rows of identical brick buildings. Not just another city, but another country, another dimension. We're talking, folks, as close as Minneapolis-St. Paul. We're talking as close as Seattle-Tacoma. We're talking as close as Portland, Beaver, what?
Vancouver.
Portland, Vancouver, and they're not even the river dividing them. but another country, another dimension, a wholly different world. Children playing in the dirty streets, cars and wrecks of cars and tatty backyards, barbers plying their trade on street corners, open spaces devoid of all signs of vegetation, smoking from large rubbish dumps and swarming with boys playing soccer. In many places there were hideous burnt-out skeletons of buses and buildings. Smaller groups of children running ahead of the white Dodge, laughing and waving as if the wrecks and ruins didn't even exist and nothing had ever happened. Clusters of policemen in battle dress patrolling shopping centers, beer halls, schools. Where are we going, Stanley? Said Ben. Nearly there, Lamy. And then... After his journey, it's an image, I guess, that puts all this together. Ben is talking to Stanley about the experience in Soweto. I don't think I ever really knew, and it's italicized, I don't think I ever really knew before. Or if I did, it didn't seem to directly concern me. It was, well, like the dark side of the moon. But now, I love this, people have landed there. So this place off, I mean, his neighbor place was the dark side of the moon. But now, people have landed there. And one of the stories that he hears that's absolutely incredulous to him is a story by a black woman just about their life. And they talk a lot about
Ben does, about the hope he has in the system and the hope of getting justice. And he's listening to black people in the village, and it's not a village, in this slum area that's got 7 million people in it, telling stories. And the paragraph is, "And another woman with a body and breasts of an earth mother said, 'I had 7 sons, sir, but 5 of them are no longer with me. They were taken one after the other. One was killed by the Tutsis. One was knifed at a soccer match. One was a staff writer on a train and he fell down and the wheels went over him. One died in the mines and the police took one. But I have 2 sons left. And so I say to Emily," that's the wife of the janitor who was hanged, or who hanged, well, no, wasn't yet. "And so I say to Emily, she must be happy for the children that she has with her today, because death is always with us." That experience is so foreign. Death, I mean, what, don't you get upset? Aren't you going to go cry for justice? No, it's always here. This is what it's like. And the very nature of their existence is so foreign to Ben that you get the point, right? He can't even grasp, "Well, why don't you struggle against this?" And they don't struggle against it because there is no hope to fight the system. Because when they do struggle against it, you know, the boy marches, and what happens? They find out later in the book he was shot by police people. And the father investigates, and what happens? He hangs himself in his jail. Perhaps the most direct statement about this movement from community or into community in the process comes in this wonderful book, and the bookstore will be happy that I'm promoting it. There's a couple copies in the bookstore still. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. In this book, who cares, but I'm going to tell you anyway, is my favorite character in all of literature. Her name is Pilot Dead. And Pilot Dead is a woman who is ostracized by her community because she has no navel. And they look at her and say, "Oh my gosh, what, are you some kind of a mermaid?" And she's just ostracized from all kinds of relationships, whether they're community relationships. Her brother disowns her, and she has one sexual encounter with a man that's a beautiful encounter until he sees her. And gosh, what are you? And then he says, one says, "What are you, some kind of mermaid?" And he runs off. So she's denied any kind of communal relationships with anybody, and in the process of that, becomes very aware of what she really cares about. Well, Pilot Dead is really kind of the main character of this book, I guess, along with her nephew, who is on this journey toward community that Pilot has already reached, even though she's isolated and ostracized from community. Another character in this young guy's life is Pilot's brother. Remember I said this young man's name is Milkman. And Milkman is the son of Pilot's brother, so Pilot is his aunt. His father, who is also black and in this community, has only one concern in life, and that's to make it. And you'll get that sense here. So we're talking about 3 characters. Milkman, the young boy, who's learning from his aunt and from his father 2 different ways to look at the world. And this is his father's attitude toward life. Now, his father carries a chain of keys on his belt because he's a landlord, and he's the richest black man in town. And he married the doctor's daughter, the only black doctor in town, and he married her daughter, and he won't let his own daughter go out with some guy. She's 41 years old. Won't let her go out with some guy because he's not high enough on the social ladder. Early in the book, Pilate's brother says to his son, to her nephew, "Boy, you got better things to do with your time than hanging out over at Pilate's. Besides, it's time you started learning how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office, work a couple of hours there, and learn what's real. Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. Let me tell you right now the one important thing you'll ever need to know. Own things. And let the things you own other things. Then you'll own yourself and other people too. And starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how." So, his value, clearly,
no good either, is it? And then those things will own other things, and I'm going to teach you how. And Pilate's got knowledge about some other world, but not this one. And any word jump out at you in that? That's an unfair question. Just run it by you so fast. I'm going to read it again. You start Monday after school, come to my office, work a couple of hours there, and learn what's real. That's the word. This is real. And the stuff that Pilate can teach you isn't real. Well, Pilate's the ostracized one, and that experience is spelled out clearly. Finally, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, remember this sentence forever. I tell my students, I want you to write this on your forehead backwards so when you brush your teeth in the morning, you'll see it in the mirror. If you want to memorize a book. When she realized what her situation would always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. There's the existential stripping. There's the awareness of self that says, what? And listen to her ask the questions. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad and what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What's true in the world? Her mind traveled crooked streets and aimless goat paths, arriving sometimes at profundity, other times at the revelations of a three-year-old. And throughout this fresh, if common, pursuit of knowledge, one conviction crowned her efforts. Since death held no terrors for her, she spoke often to the dead, she knew there was nothing to fear. So maybe we all can't accomplish that, but anything that could possibly get in the way, the fears to look at are myself, and she's not afraid of anything. Therefore, I'm going to ask the question, what makes me happy? Am I happy when I'm out there pouring the chemicals on my lawn and making this beautiful green lawn and I work my butt off on it on Saturday? I'd really rather be sitting in the river with my kids, or I'd rather be reading a book, or I'd rather be taking a nap. But I got this lawn I got to get ready, and I'm going to do that. Am I happy then? I mean, that's a concrete illustration, and you can find your own, and we'll come to that in a second. When am I happy, when am I sad, and what is the difference? And what do I need to know to stay alive in the world? Does that fit some of the stuff Tinker taught us, I guess? Well, Pilate can't survive, and she's murdered at the end of the book, and Milkman, her nephew, is there, and he's learned. Milkman, in the process, without telling you the whole story, Pilate has a big bag of junk hanging from her ceiling, and her brother, Milkman's dad, thinks it's gold. And he says, I want you to go in and get that gold because that belongs to me too. I'm her brother and that's from our father and that's partly. And they go in there and they find out it's a bag of bones. Well, then the gold must be someplace else. The gold their father had because he owned land. Milkman, go find it. And he goes and searches for the gold because he still believes I want to own things. I'm going to have money. I'm going to carry a chain of keys on my belt too. And in the process of this, he's out in the woods and he loses. Literally, he loses everything on his back. His watch brand breaks and he loses it. His billfold gets lost in the woods. His suit gets all torn up. His shoes come off and he loses them. And one after one, and he has a briefcase full of stuff and he loses his briefcase. One after one, he is, and there's my phrase, existentially stripped of all the stuff that was a part of his life before. And now he's got to say the same questions that Pilate asked. When am I happy? I got this gold. I don't have my gold watch anymore. Am I still happy? Well, I got my... I have my billfold. Am I still happy? I got my car batting away back there and it didn't start. So he doesn't have that. He doesn't have anything. And now he's got to ask all those questions. Well, he comes to the same realization that Pilate did. And Pilate, at the end of the novel, dies in Milkman's arms. She is murdered. She is shot. She stood up then. It seemed to Milkman that he heard the shot after she fell. He dropped to his knees and cradled her lolling head in the crook of his arm, barking at her, "You hurt! You hurt, Pilate!" She laughed softly, and he knew right away that she was reminded of the day he first met her and that he had said the most stupid thing there was to say. I mean, here she is shot, and he's asking, are you hurt? And the twilight had thickened, and all around them it was getting dark. Milkman moved his hand over her chest and stomach, trying to find the place where she might be hit. Pilot, you be okay? He couldn't make out her eyes. His hand under her head was sweating like a fountain. Pilot. She sighed. Watch Reba. That's her daughter from that one union that she had. She sighed, watch Reba for me. And then she said, I wish I'd have known more people. I would have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more. And throughout that novel, her ability to love all kinds of characters is spelled out in beautiful episode after episode. Some of them are funny, some of them are violent, but they're all beautiful and they're all poignant. And they suggest to us this process of first becoming aware of the self and all the values and the value that is most often part of us, the rugged individualism of the American experience, to turn in on myself and say, what's in it for me? It's the same question that Satan told God to ask Job. It's the same question that Peter asked Jesus in a different way. Hey, Jesus, what's in it for me? And we keep asking that question, what's in it for me? And as we watch Pilate, and as we watch Ben in the dry white season, and as we listen to the poet speak in the Tumbling Rocks, the Mending Wall story, that the characters themselves have to first become aware of who they are and what they value. And then they have to begin this process of stripping that value and walking away from it. To walk away from the whole idea of the ethnocentrism that Ben has into another world that says, that's my brother too. To walk into an idea that says, like Zechariah says so well, these are the things that you shall do. Speak the truth to one another. Render in your gates judgments that are true, and make for peace. And I think literature heads us toward that sense of community. And we have about 5 minutes yet to let you respond and talk about community in ways that you've seen it in literature or any way you want. Or respond to the stuff that you can.
I was thinking about Pilate and how our self-awareness, our messages of understanding, like our community or who we are, what we are, come from those often who are on the outside, who have a better perspective than people caught up in the world.
That's a great observation, and I think as a student of African American literature, I know that's where I've learned the most about our society and its values, because they don't get to participate in those values. Mm-hmm. And they're pointing out, well, look what you value.
Again, so somehow they're queer than we are. Yeah. We have more restrictive because of our advantages.
Right, yeah. That's a great point. Sell all you have, said Jesus. And the man went away very sad because he had much. Who?
I was just going to say a writer that I've read recently that's fairly new on the scene, I guess, is Bailey White. And she has also done some things on PBS radio. But she describes some scenes in living with her mother in a southern state. And her mother is this very genuine, real person who believes that as she gets old, she has more freedom to live and be real. And she's trying to teach her daughter in some certain ways. And one way she does is that she moves her bathtub onto her front porch so she can take her bath.
What a great image, yeah.
It's great. And there's her mom, very real, sitting in her bathtub, having this, that was an image I have too, in terms of what a real, how glorious, we use the bubble in the bathtub here to kind of do some of that too, but it's such a genuine, the genuineness of people in literature, and this is a true story, that makes it even nicer.
Well, this is a true story, too.
Is it?
Yeah. It's not historically factual.
It's really,
but it's true. But I understand what you're saying, that is the neat thing. Yeah.
What was the name of it again?
Song of Solomon. Toni Morrison wrote Tar Baby, Sula, Beloved. Something I didn't like. I can't remember. That's appropriate, isn't it? I only didn't like it. I can't remember the title. Tart Baby, I guess that was. Anybody else? Let me leave you with a poem that fits this idea, and it's Robert Frost again. We started with him and come back to him. Listen to him and what he says about the decision-making process and the awareness required in that very, very famous poem, Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood, and Sorry I Could Not Travel Both. And think about this poem in light of community and the sense of self and the sense of other, and you can't travel both. Unless you have the kind of, you have the awareness of yourself. Okay, so two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, and then took the other. It's just as fair, perhaps, and having for that day the passing there had warned them really about the same. Oh, I saved the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. And I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That's a poem about community, too. So it's supper time, or lunch time. Get your salad. Anybody else said anything? We still really have a few minutes, but if you want, but you're free to go.
Are you going to have another point under awareness?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know the word, and maybe you can help me with that word. Once you're self-aware, then you have, I use the word stripping, or how do you, I use the word negation, so that's not a very good word.
Emptiness.
What?
Kenosis is the Bible word. And the emptying, self-emptying.
Okay, self-emptying. Self-emptying, I love it. Better, I mean, I've used the word in my own mind of stripping, existential stripping. I'll, you know, take away your tie, and then, you know, you're talking to a student, I'll get my tie off, oops, all of a sudden, I'm like you, you know, like that, which, you know, stripping. But emptying is much better. That's deeper, and that's inside, and that's not just your tie.
So then what's the existential filling after that step?
Ben Du Toit's journey. Into Soweto, into an awareness of others, into a sense of community. Milkman's journey into the sense of, I have gotten rid of, I emptied myself of own things, and I filled myself with, I thought I knowed more people, I'd have loved more people. I mean, it's a replacement of values. It's a great question. You know, what do you replace it with? And I don't think literature just leaves us hanging any more than the Bible does, and the Bible is literature. It doesn't, there are answers to that, you know. You empty, there's something to fill it. Anybody else? Right, there's a $300 deposit, Bill, on that book.
What's that poem about a mite Nevada cider? Is that Sandberg or is that Frost?
Geez, I don't know. I know that, but I don't know. Yeah, write that down. Bill Cole asked me a question I couldn't answer, and it ticks me off. Students ask that, I just write down C for that kid.
Smart aleck.
Yeah, smart aleck.